So we all know that Michigan is fortunate to have an abundance of fresh water. Obviously, we're the Great Lakes State. We're surrounded with fresh water. We've got water and lakes and rivers throughout the state, and even a huge abundance of groundwater. But there are a lot of threats to that groundwater, including pollution, water diversion, and, as we know from Flint, problems with the infrastructure as well. So that's what we're going to be discussing tonight. And leading our discussion this evening is Rebecca Williams. You may know Rebecca as the host of the Environment Report on Michigan Radio. All right. And Rebecca also informed me that she is very soon celebrating her 17th year at Michigan Radio. So obviously she started when she was about 6 years old at Michigan Radio. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Michigan Radio, or to Michigan Radio's Rebecca Williams, and she'll introduce our panel.
Hello, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'll introduce our panelists. Lindsay Smith has been Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter for more than 6 years, but next month she'll start as the station's new investigative reporter. You may know her from such things as the Flint water crisis. Garrett Ellison is over here. He's been a reporter for MLive and the Grand Rapids Press for 10 years. He primarily covers the Great Lakes and Michigan's environment and has spent a lot of time writing about Nestle's bid to increase Michigan water extraction.
You've heard of it.
You've heard of that, I hear. I see.
The ongoing debate over Enbridge Line 5.
You've heard of that one, too?
And the expanding Air Force chemical pollution in Oscoda lately. And starting all the way to my right, we have Dr. Joan Rose. She's an internationally recognized expert in water microbiology, water quality, and public health and safety. She is also the 2016 recipient of the Stockholm Water Prize. This is the world's most prestigious water award. It's the Nobel Prize for Water. And then directly to Dr. Rose's left, we have Jim Brody. He's a senior project manager at, I'm sorry, I didn't ask you for the pronunciation. Fleece? It's bad radio. Fleece and Vanderbrink Engineering. He's a groundwater consultant to industry, landowners, and municipalities around the state, including Kalamazoo. He's also a longtime consultant working on the Paul Gelman dioxane plume in Ann Arbor. Welcome to Jim. And directly to my right, John Paquin. He's the Water Resources Division Manager for the City of Kalamazoo, Department of Public Services. He's worked for the city for 25 years. Before that, he worked as a consultant in Kalamazoo and in St. Louis, Missouri. So welcome also to John. I also wanted to let you know we did reach out to the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. A spokesperson told us they wanted to come here tonight, but nobody was available to join us. So just so you know. So I want to start first, and Dr. Rose, I'd like to start with you. I want to get personal with all of you and ask you where you get your drinking water. Where do you live, and where do you get your drinking water? What's your source?
Yeah, so I live in Williamston. I have my own well. We do a lot of studies in my lab, and so we need groundwater, so I get my groundwater tested quite a bit. I take it into the lab. And one of the things that does worry me is that we have a lot of people in Michigan on groundwater, and we don't test, and we don't know what's going on under the ground. And we certainly want to avoid any kind of problem like we saw north in Walkerton, where, a small community, farming community, had their well contaminated because of rainfall, faulty well design. I know you're going to be addressing that. And contaminants to bacteria from manure. And also the water utility people were cheating, lying about how they were treating the water. So, people got sick, kids died. You know, you walk into a community where, a small community where kids died from their tap water. In North America, it's really heart-wrenching. And we don't want to have that happen here in Michigan. And so I'm a big promoter of testing groundwater and testing our water systems. If we test, we can manage. We can find out where the pollution's coming from. We have new tools. So I'm a big promoter for that.
Jim, where do you get your water, and what gives you confidence that it's safe to drink?
Well, my wife and I have a home on the northwest side of Kalamazoo, so we're one of the 25% of the people in the state that derive our ground or water, drinking water, from groundwater. We have our own well. When we built our house, one of the things we did was we sent a sample of that water to a local lab. Carr Labs has a wonderful program that supports homeowners to have low-cost analyses done of their water supply. So we did that and looked for those major pollutants and chemicals that we find in groundwater, and that was our way of assuring ourselves that we had a safe water supply.
I also have a private groundwater well, live out in the country area west of Kalamazoo, and like was indicated, kind of a farm country, so nitrates was kind of a concern for me in the area because there used to be hog farming in the region, and so I knew there was some elevated nitrate. So there's also some informal township dump spots that are all over the state, so that's something too to be aware of. So I did my research also before I bought my home for the same reasons. So groundwater, but a private well.
I want to let you know that John told me that the water in your beer comes from the city of Kalamazoo.
Okay, so when the Flint water crisis happened, it's kind of coincided with something else that happened in my life that had nothing really to do with the Flint water crisis, other than I have my oldest child was turning a year old, and because of our zip code, because I live in the city of Grand Rapids and I live in a part of the city that is generally has lead and pain or whatever, and so they tested my kid based on my zip code, and she had tested just above elevated levels for lead. So I got my water tested. It cost me $25 a pop. I got it tested 3 times. I know I have a copper water pipe. I know I get my water from Lake Michigan. I know that none of my water tests had any lead in them, but I would love to know more about my water besides lead. That's something that I think I'd try to do in the future. But I feel pretty confident about my water supply. I feel like I know enough about Grand Rapids operation and everything else that I'm pretty confident in the supply for sure.
I've lived in Grand Rapids for most of the last decade, but I most recently, over the last few months, moved to Sparta, Michigan. I know that they get their water from several groundwater wells. You can see them as you drive into town. We have a home filter on our tap that we use that I've mostly relied on in lieu of being able to really do much more, some testing or some more thorough investigation as to, you know, what's going on with Sparta water, other than reading their most recent water quality report, which doesn't have any red flags for me at this point. So that's where things are at with me and my water.
What do you wish, John, what do you wish more of us knew about our drinking water?
It is safe and reliable. The biggest challenge we have here in Kalamazoo, which really is pretty common for groundwater sources across Michigan, is aesthetic issues. And iron's always a challenge, hardness is a challenge, but that's an aesthetic issue, not a safety issue. And part of what we try to do is really educate people. Everybody's concerned, and they should be concerned, but you feel more comfortable once you have the facts. And so we're trying hard to educate people about our water system and being very honest about the aesthetic challenges. So I think that's the one thing I would want to communicate is, and don't hesitate to call when you have questions. We have a website, protectyourwater.net. It's a great site to go to, and there's a contact form there as well. So we're open. We want to hear your concerns, and we'll respond to them the best we can.
Joan, how would you answer that question?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the, I guess the outcomes of the tragedy in Flint is that it's really changed the national conversation about water and about testing and being responsive. And there are, I think, water utilities that have always been really responsive and been thinking about not just, you know, this safety, because we have a yardstick of what's safe, and we test for that. If you're doing a great job, changing the numbers. But there's wholesomeness. There's wholesomeness, and people want wholesomeness, and that means that it smells good, it looks good, it tastes good. And so, you know, I really, I was always like, who is speaking for the, you know, the community water supply? Because they're, for the most part, their motto is 24/7 safe and wholesome water. And if you have a problem, call. And so, and I think that that's been heightened because of Flint. I think there's more responsiveness now. There's more willingness for people to speak up and say, even within the utility, wait, you know, we're having a problem here. Let's go investigate it. So I think there's been a real, you know, a change in our consciousness and our efforts around drinking water and our tap water all across the country, and because of what happened, and especially in Michigan.
So piggybacking off of that, what should we know about our water in our own homes? In terms of when should you test and what kind of filter should you use, and does it matter where you live in Michigan what kind of filter you should use? Why don't you start with that one too, Dr.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I was amazed because I've given lectures to professionals as well as the layperson, and even professionals, it was like 60% didn't know where their water came from. Like, it came from the tap. Well, no. Yeah, it's delivered through the pipes in the tap system. And they didn't know where their water went when they flushed the toilet. So I like for, you know, people to know that, know those two things. I think we have to have stories about, everybody really cares about their water. You know, you have your favorite beach, your favorite stream you fish at, you know, your favorite creek or whatever it is, and people do really care about their water. And so I'd really like people to just know, if they know those two things. If you're on a utility, you can always call the utility and find out more and hopefully get someone that most utilities are trying to get people that can really communicate the science so that it's not, you know. Usually my mother calls me when she gets the water report, you know, and says, what's this? But, you know, the general people need to be able to call someone. And so a lot of utilities, I think you must be having someone that took a lot of questions right after Flint probably as well. And about point of use device, you know, how do you get the right point of use device filter, right?
Right. And depending on, you know, what you're trying to filter out, I think that's the first thing people have to understand is what is the issue. I mean, do you have an issue? And if you are concerned with iron, there's iron filters. Hardness, most people have softeners, different types of, you know, dealing with the hardness. So, but if there's other contaminant issues or concerns, lead, for instance, if, you know, we provide filters to people that we know have lead in the interim before the lead service is removed. So it's educating yourself, and if you don't know the answers, ask those who do know, and there's a lot of help out there. So
yeah, if I can just real quick piggyback, something that I learned that I think when I talk to people about this, and people ask me like, oh, what's going on in Flint, or what can we take away from Flint, you know, kind of what you were saying is know where your water comes from, and like in my case, right, so I live in the city of Grand Rapids. I call the city. I didn't say, hey, this is Lindsay Smith. I'm a reporter at Michigan Radio. Can you hook me up with my, you know, service? What is my service line made out of? And yada, yada, yada. No, I called like 311, like a normal person, and said, hey, my name's Lindsay Shinjack Smith. That's my married name. And said, you know, like, I'm looking for information about this. And within 45 minutes, they emailed me. Grand Rapids, in their case, has all of their water records for what your service line is made out of. They have all of them electronically, or a significant portion of them electronically. So within 45 minutes, they emailed me and said, yeah, sure, here's a map of your house. Here's the records we have. I mean, it didn't take a FOIA request. It was very... So if you you know, it very much, it varies by city, and I don't know if that would be the same case if I called you in Kalamazoo, if you'd be able to whip that out in 45 minutes electronically. Challenge is on, but I think it's important for people to know, you know. I think people care about that. And so, you know, finding out a basic question like, do I have a lead service line in front of my house, that can at least let you know. You know, especially if you have young children, like in my case, like, all right, I have a 2.5-year-old, I have a 10-month-old, I know you have a small kid. Just knowing that basic information can be really handy for your peace of mind before you go out and test and do other things.
Well, no, and Jim, so a lot of Michiganders are on private wells, and as you mentioned, Joan, we don't require much testing. It depends where you live, right, for a well. So what's your advice to people who are on wells in terms of what do you look up for? How do you protect yourself?
Well, I think it's important to talk about the fact that we derive our water, a lot of us, especially if we're in the Kalamazoo area, from groundwater. And groundwater is unique when compared to surface water. There's, you know, Lindsay gets her water from Grand Rapids, and it's a surface water source where we, in Kalamazoo County, for the most part, almost exclusively derive our water from groundwater. And groundwater is a wonderful source for drinking water. In some states, if you go to California, for instance, there's the separation between wastewater and water is not so great because water's a little bit more scarce in California. There's a lot of water reuse. Wastewater becomes in close proximity to our groundwater sources. But here in this glacial landscape that we have, we're pulling water from, we have an isolation from a lot of wastewater sources. That's not to say our water is not vulnerable. But we have a great water supply available to us. So that's something just to keep in mind. You know, one of the things that from our we have a wellhead protection team here in Kalamazoo that works on strategies to protect our water supply. And one of the basic things that we try to communicate or make sure that people are aware of is the fact that they get their water from groundwater, because a lot of people don't know that. And I think your first question was really important, because where is your water coming from? So,
I'd like to ask how many people have saw a pre-movie ad at Celebration Cinema or Kalamazoo 10 about, okay, those are part of our wellhead protection campaign. And the first one we did was, where do you think you get your water from? You know, A, Kalamazoo River, B, Lake Michigan. And I think that was the first place we wanted to start to have people understand where they get their drinking water source from. Two is, you know, what they do, their behavior on the land can adversely impact that water supply. And three is ways that they can help protect it.
Garrett, let's hear from you. You've been sitting over here very patiently.
Sure.
So let's talk about bottled water. You've been certainly covering bottled water a lot in the last couple of years.
I know more about bottled water now than I would have thought had you asked me a couple years ago, definitely.
So the state says there are 49 companies that bottle water in Michigan. How much of an impact does this have on our groundwater supply?
In terms of impact on the groundwater supply overall, in a broad sense, that's not a very big impact. Bottled water companies withdrawing groundwater, it pales in comparison to other uses like agricultural. Irrigation is huge. Golf course irrigation is just a ridiculous amount of water. I think the largest single water user in Michigan is the Donald Cook Nuclear Plant in Berrien County, which pulls billions of gallons every year from Lake Michigan and then cycles it through the reactor and puts it right back into Lake Michigan. So bottled water is not in itself a enormous factor. What I think in terms of the Nestle situation is that there's different types of aquifers that you can withdraw groundwater from, and I think part of the big reaction to Nestle is the fact that it's seen as drawing groundwater from an environmentally sensitive aquifer that is near the surface. They want the spring water label on their Ice Mountain brand. And in order to do that, they have to draw from a very specific type of aquifer that is, can show the U.S. FDA vents to the surface as a spring somewhere in the vicinity. And in doing so, that is, there's a lot of evidence that shows that when you're drawing spring water out of the ground, you're denying it to systems like drought streams and wetlands and whatnot that kind of rely on that water. So, you know, municipal systems that may have very deep wells are not impacting the surface waters in the same way that Nestle and certain spring water bottlers would be. And certain other water bottlers, like I think Dasani is Detroit River Water that's put through a lot of fancy filtration process. It's purified water, right? If you go to the store and you look at bottled water, you've got a couple of different kinds of options. Most people don't even realize the difference when they're grabbing one. They just want a bottle of water. There's purified water, which is usually just municipal water that's run through a bunch of extra filtration and then bottled. And then there's spring water, which is a very specific type of aquifer. It's got a different taste if you have a very, very discerning palate. But for the most part, I think it's a marketing thing.
Does Fiji water really come from Fiji?
I have no idea, but I doubt
I've
it.
I've always wondered. It's that yes. box one, you know?
Yes, it does.
It does?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact.
I'm impressed.
They and in fact, the natives there don't have water scarcity, and they're shipping water to the rest of the world through Fiji bottled water. Yeah.
So the it's a long answer to your question, but you know, bottled water is it's kind of an apples to oranges thing, right? It really depends on where you're pulling it from.
So the state has a water withdrawal tool, right? So that's supposed to tell them if there's enough water. Is it too much? You reported on this. Is it foolproof?
No, not at all. In fact, there's some pretty fierce critics of the water withdrawal tool. The DEQ, there's some pretty large debate over the water withdrawal tool as to whether or not it masks impacts in certain types of environments. Nestle, the relation from with Nestle to the water withdrawal tool is that when they asked the DEQ last year or recently to approve their request to extract more groundwater, the state ran it through this tool, which is just a computer model that predicts what kind of resource impacts it would have. Right? Will it hurt the temperature of the nearby streams and therefore harm the fish population, that kind of thing. The water withdrawal tool gave Nestle a failing grade, gave it a D, as in likely to have an adverse resource impact, likely to hurt the fish population, that sort of thing. You can get around that. There's an end run around the tool that the state allows for called a site-specific review. In which case that you can go to the staff and say, well, we have this other data that sort of contradicts the tool, which the DEQ claims is overly conservative. And, you know, you can basically have the staff kind of take another look, take a look at some different ways of looking at that data. And in Nestle's case, the staff overruled the tool and then approved the increase.
The water withdrawal tool was really, it's an analytical model. It's not a complicated numerical model like we have to use in our wellhead protection delineation model. So it's meant to be a kind of a gross screening tool. And matter of fact, it doesn't work very well at all in Southwest Michigan, so much that the previous DEQ director mandated a committee to study it. And I was on that committee representing municipal water, but it was heavily populated, the committee, by big irrigators, very, very large. And I don't know if a lot of folks know, but I believe it's factual that St. Joe County here withdraws more irrigated water than any place east of the Mississippi. So we use a lot of water for agriculture in this part of the state. So what the site-specific review end around is more of if it's going to fail, they want more specific data. So that data is real data. So if an applicant fails, they can say, hey, you know, we're going to have our hydrogeologic consultant go in there, do some wells, do an aquifer performance test, and have some facts. Because the model, you know, the model isn't meant to be super complex. It's kind of a gross screening tool. So those that are really not fit for withdrawal, they'll catch those. But the water withdrawal tool, if you pump 70 gallons per minute or more, you're under that rule. So it's not a lot of water as far as we're concerned, 70 gallons per minute, since we pump a lot of water. But DEQ is working with other folks and that use the heavy water users to try to make the tool better. There's a lot of recommendations that came out of that committee that went to the state committee. So they're still trying to determine where best to spend additional money to get better data. For instance, better stream data. You mentioned this all goes down to how it impacts fish and index flows and surface water. So the state needs more gauges. They need more gauges out there in the streams and more groundwater data so they can make those correlations. Because it's pretty interesting when the DEQ is trying to argue with a farmer who's been farming three generations and been pumping the amount of water, and they live next to a stream and never have impacted it, but the model says they do. That's crazy. So you have to have an alternative to use real data so you can make sound decisions.
We're getting a signal that we want to open it up for questions, but did you want to weigh in on this quickly, either of you, before we move on to questions from the audience? Are we missing anything here?
No. You know, I think, you know, the fact that Nestle chose to collect their own data, that's pretty common when someone fails on this tool. And what we have in the state with that tool, because it's the way the tool works is it looks at depletion of streams, water from streams. So if you're pumping groundwater over 70 gallons a minute, it looks at how much water is coming out of a stream, and then it looks at characteristic fish populations and evaluates whether or not that pumping will impact the fish population. So, and John alluded to that. So it's when we have we find in our work that a lot of the northern Michigan sites, Everett, and where we have relatively small watersheds that are trout streams, the tool is really, it fails a lot in those environments. So we work with a lot of northern Michigan communities pumping water for water supplies, municipal supplies, and so forth. And a lot of times that tool will fail. And then that prompts us and our clients or municipalities to look at site-specific information. So what Nestle did looking at site-specific information is you know, it was an end around, but it also is something that a lot of others do.
Do you have anything to add?
Well, I just think the bottled water industry has sort of a philosophical problem, yeah, that a lot of other water users don't have, and that is the charge of potable water in a bottle, which is very expensive compared to the rest of the water. And we don't value water, so we don't charge when we charge for our we charge people infrastructure, and even if it doesn't work, we're charging them a lot of money to get it to our tap. But we don't charge the farmer, we don't charge other industries, or we don't charge the bottled water industry very much money to pump that water out, right? We've got a lot of water, and we you know, and I think we need to think about valuing water.
That was a huge point of contention at this hearing, at the Nestle hearing, if anybody was out there. Yeah, okay. So, you know, I mean, people, I would say, were outraged that the DEQ even compared Nestle to agriculture. Because they said, look, they're watering the fields and they're making me some peppers or peaches or whatever it is, right? There's a product. Your product, they see it as more directly derived, and that the state's not really going to make any money off of that. Some people feel like that just in and of itself is not, that's not cool, right. If I can put it that
exactly
way.
Right. There's The $200 filing fee for...
Right.
You know, there's a lot of people that believe that there should be some sort of extraction per gallon fee or something of that, something along the lines of the way that the state collects royalties for oil and gas and fossil fuels and that sort of other minerals, that kind of thing. And, you know, sort of in my reporting over the last 6 months or so, you know, I tried to figure out exactly, you know, why is it that Nestle is allowed to essentially extract, you know, billions of gallons over the last 10 years or so, which sounds like a lot, and it is, but at the same time, in comparison to other uses, it really isn't. And it's, you know, it gets to this idea that Michigan common law allows reasonable use of the water underneath your property as long as it doesn't hurt neighboring property owners, right? So you can't take so much water. It's a tragedy of the commons thing, right? So you can't take so much water out from underneath your property that it's going to hurt a neighbor's well or it's going to dry up a stream somewhere. But as long as it doesn't do any of that, and your science, or you can convince the regulators that it's not going to do any of that, then you're pretty much allowed to take as much as you want, as much as you're willing to invest in the overhead and infrastructure to extract it. Now, that's obviously doesn't sit well with a lot of people because they see it as a public resource that's being privatized. So I think there's a pretty... There's a lot of debate to be had about that right now, and I'm starting to hear some kind of rumblings a little bit out of Lansing that there's some legislators who are starting to talk in that regard. Although, in order to figure out some sort of legislation, I think that would allow for the farmer who needs the irrigation well to water his crops, and Nestle, you know, who do you charge, and how much do you charge, and how is that impacting a regular person versus a major corporation, the world's largest water bottling company? It's a pretty complex problem.
All right, we want to open it up for your questions. So Lindsay Scullin is going to come over to you. And if you can just say your name, where you're from, and your question, please.
Hi, I'm Phil Hall. I live here in Kalamazoo. But I was just curious, with the irrigation water, how much of that water goes back into the ground? How much gets evaporated? And does that factor into your into the calculations?
I can say that irrigation is one of the largest consumptive uses of groundwater. So meaning that irrigation water does evaporate, transpire, goes into the atmosphere. So it's one of, in terms of consumptive uses, irrigation is one of the more consumptive uses that we have. You know, compared to an industrial supply like Cook Nuclear Plant, it's pumping that water out and pretty much returning it to the lake. Irrigation has a high consumptive ratio. So it's a significant water user.
Yeah, I mean, the goal for food and ag is really efficiency. So I think that the future for agriculture and water is to say, can we be more efficient, right? Because, you know, we take water, it goes into our cells, that's a consumptive use, and then we return it through other means, right, back to the environment. And so in this landscape of Michigan with variable climate the way we have, the rain runs off. We have tile drains. So we have a lot of pollution coming from non-point sources in our rural communities. And so how do we handle that? And then how do we, when we do need to irrigate, because now we're going to have many more drought, or we're in an area where there's many more days or the crops need more irrigation, can we be more efficient? Can we... You know, the goal is for every drop to be consumptive, right? Every drop of water that you put on an ag field to go into the plant. That's the goal, and not run off. That's the ultimate goal, I think. But we do know that non-point source pollution is a pretty significant problem for our waterways in Michigan.
One thing I learned on that committee is for Southwest Michigan was I got a real... good appreciation for the agricultural industry and the irrigators. It's a lot different than what it was decades ago. They're a lot smarter. They're higher tech. They watch the dollars more, so they don't want to pump anything more than what they have to because it costs them more. Same thing with chemical applications. MSU is a great resource for getting all that data and consumptive use per crops and all that. But I did learn a lot because it isn't all just, you know, potatoes and corn heavy irrigators. There's a, you know, flower industries like gladiolas. I think the biggest gladiola farm, I think, on the planet, I think, at least in the country, is down in Michigan, southern Michigan, near Coldwater area. So they have gotten smarter. That's the good news. Do they have a ways to go? Yeah, I think they do, as all the industries do, but they've come a long way, I think, in the last 20 years.
Well, and to Phil, right? You said, Phil, I don't know if you know this, and put you on the spot here. It's my Nestle guy. All right, so... But one of the things that I heard at this hearing and that I've, like, learned, or that Nestle says, is that they, you know, they regionally distribute whatever they get from Michigan. So their sort of their argument is that, you know, to Phil's point, right, directly to your point, the water stays here because we're not shipping it back to Sweden. We're not putting it, you know, to California.
No,
sending it to the beach.
Garrett's not buying it.
No, you know, I mean, to some degree, yes. There's a law that the Great Lakes Compact, which you may have heard of, prohibits water diversions out of the Great Lakes Basin. This was a big deal with Waukesha, Wisconsin, wanting to tap Lake Michigan for water. They're just on the other side of the line, but they got it. But there's a loophole in that law that allows you to ship water as far away as you want, as long as it's in
small
gallons.
Bottles, right?
Yeah, smaller than 5.7 gallons.
Which is what they make up there?
Surprisingly enough, that's the largest container they make at the Ice Mountain Bottled Water Factory. So they send... If you want to see where Ice Mountain goes, look up Ice Mountain Water on Twitter. And if they haven't changed it yet, there's a little map of the U.S. that says Ice Mountain Country, and it's basically the Midwest, including the Dakotas, which are certainly not within the Great Lakes Basin. That's sort of their. They say it's within 250 miles of the factory is the main distribution. Well, the Dakotas are certainly outside of that. As are most of the rest of the Great Lakes Basin, but they have the option of sending it anywhere they want, and they have they do a lot of water quality testing in order to have the option of sending it to all 50 states if they want. Now, if you look at any bottle of water, it's going to tell you where it comes from. Right, it says so right on the label. Most 20-ounce bottles of Ice Mountain water are going to say comes from White Pine Springs, Everett, and Sanctuary Springs in Canadian Lakes or Mecosta County. But if you look at one of the larger jugs of Ice Mountain water, it doesn't come from Michigan. It comes from Pennsylvania. And some of their... flavored brands of Ice Mountain water, like lemon sparkling Ice Mountain water, comes from Rocky Mountain sources, right? So there's a large question as to what kind of, you know, where they're sending Michigan water under what brand, and what kind of water from elsewhere is coming to Michigan under certain brands. And I know that the wells at the Stanwood plant, which take almost half their supply, source that goes into their Pure Life brand, their purified water brand. Well, that's Michigan groundwater. It's not as environmentally sensitive as spring water, but it's still Michigan groundwater, and they can ship that everywhere, and they do. That Pure Life is a national brand. I've had people send me photos of Nestle Pure Life being distributed in Afghanistan to troops. So, I guess it's a long-winded answer to the question, but yeah, they They can send it everywhere.
As long as it's under a certain size.
Right. As long as it's in a container smaller than 5.7 gallons, you can send it anywhere.
All right, next questions.
So I'm John from Charlotte. There was a lot of sound and fury over the appointment of the MDEQ. I don't know what the position is. It's the head
director
person.
Director Grether?
Yeah, the one from Reed Enbridge and the Kalamazoo water spill and Line 5. So I haven't heard a thing pretty much since about the first week or two. What do you guys know about that?
Director Grether, there's been a lot. You're right. There has been a lot of sort of sound and fury. You know, people looked at her appointment as being like a slap in the face to environmental protection, the fox guarding the hen house, that sort of thing. And I would say, to some degree, it depends on who you talk to. The jury is still out on that. She, to her credit, the Nestle thing, the fact that there was a public hearing, you know, if she didn't, you know, the DEQ, once it became known that Nestle was trying to extract more groundwater, the DEQ realized, oh, we didn't properly notice the public on this, and they backed up, and now they're crossing all the I's and dotting all the T's, and they're making sure that this review is as legally bulletproof as possible.
And legally, that's a specific term you mentioned.
And when I asked her at a conference, I said, "Do you think that the this was handled correctly?" She said, "No." She was fairly open, and in front of a room full of people, with a surprise question from the back, she said no, and she was fairly open about the fact that no, this wasn't handled properly. We should have definitely recognized that it was going to be controversial and made sure that people knew about it, other than this very small, tiny, hidden public notice on deep in the DEQ website. So she's got some pretty big permitting decisions coming up that will, I think, probably give you a better answer to that question. You know, I guess the jury's still out. What is she going to do about Line 5? She's co-chair of the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board, which makes a recommendation on what to do about the pipeline. That's pending. So she's got great influence in that. She's going to have to decide what to do about the Nestle permit. There's that and several other things. But the fact that she comes from BP, it looks bad, but like I said, I guess the jury's still out. You'll have to wait to see how she makes decisions as a director.
Let's take another question.
Hi, I'm Don. I'm from Kalamazoo County. As mentioned earlier on, that there are a couple of people on the panel that have dealt with some of the pollution plumes that are in Michigan, some of the more well-known ones. But I was curious just how much of a problem is that going to be for us in the future? Here in Kalamazoo, we've got the Pfizer company, used to be the Upjohn company. I know they used to do a lot of deep well injections of things. And I wondered, what kind of time bombs do we have out there ticking away? Thank you.
Well, we've been managing environmental sites, contaminated sites, for a long time. We recognized, Michigan really, I think, has been in the forefront in a lot of ways of its investigations and how to deal with these contaminated sites. And we have a lot of them in the state, no doubt. But because we've been working in these programs for a long time, we've identified a lot of the sites. A lot of these are legacy sites. We used to dispose of chemicals in a lot of improper ways way back when. We've learned a lot since then, so we don't create as many sites now as we did in the past. So anyway, we have our DEQ is on a lot of the sites that we have, and the risks have been identified and there are strategies to help clean them up. There are still sites that are unknown, and we, for instance, here in Kalamazoo, we've done a real good job of inventorying all these sites with respect to our groundwater, our drinking water supplies, our wellhead protection areas. These are the areas we get our water from. We know the sites that are in these areas, and we try to manage them, keep an eye on them. But there are a lot of sites out there. They're definitely, you look at some of these projects we work on where we have communities and where they get their water from, we call a wellhead protection area. A lot of these communities have many, many sites in a wellhead protection area. So we all have to be diligent. We have to make sure that the DEQ, which oversees the cleanup and these activities, is paying attention to these sites, that we as water users and wellhead protection teams, those working on strategies to protect these water supplies, are paying attention to these sites. So we don't find too many new sites, although that does happen. And some of these sites, we're one of the things that we're dealing with, and perhaps Joan can speak to this a little bit, is there, the one thing I've observed over my years of working in this business is that, we started off identifying certain types of chemicals that we're tracking. A lot of times it's hydrocarbons associated with gas and oil sites, or metals and plating industries and so forth, or chlorinated solvents are a big one. They're quite mobile in the groundwater. And we've looked for a lot of these sites, and what we continue to discover is that there are contaminants that we haven't thought about that are lurking out there that we're catching on, locations such as Wordsmith, you talked about that. All of a sudden we're finding, I work on this site in Ann Arbor where we have a contaminant called 1,4-dioxane, and we're finding it everywhere. The more we look, the more we find. So we know these risks, and then we get surprised occasionally that we find these sites that are out there. We talked, her expertise is in microbiology and groundwater, that's a real area where we don't look a lot for some of the microbiological contaminants that we have in groundwater or surface water. I mean, we kind of, don't look enough, and those things kind of pop up. All of a sudden, we learn more about the risks associated with some of these contaminants or biological contaminants. So it's evolving. It's evolving. We've identified a lot of the risks, but yet we're always surprised, and we're always finding new things.
Yeah, I guess that, what gives me, kind of hope for the future is that we do have a lot of new tools. We can find things at lower concentrations, which means that we can find the edge of that plume better. We can understand where it's moving. There's a lot of that's helped us. New molecular tools where we can look at the DNA in these systems and find out things that we never knew before. But on the other side of the coin, what worries me is that remediation is a long-term effort. And everyone knows that. And so you can't just stop remediation, And so if we think that we're done, and we're done with the sediment contamination, we're done with these plumes, and we're done, and we don't have to invest any more money into these things, and they're expensive in some cases, that's what worries me, is that people feeling like we're not going to keep investing in the remediation side of it.
There's like a perfect example of this up in Skoda. Is any of you here familiar with Wordsmith Air Force Base? Are you familiar with the perfluorinated chemicals issue that's happening up there? Wordsmith closed in 1993 after the Cold War, and it was known to be just a toxic soup of chlorinated solvents and hydrocarbons that had been... there had been remediation systems in place for decades, ever since the early 80s. And they really kind of thought, it was case closed almost up there. And then a couple of years ago, I think maybe about 5-10 years ago, I can't remember the exact date, but the DEQ started looking at unregulated contaminants of concern, such as perfluorinated chemicals, PFCs for short, and they said, well, let's start looking around at places that might have this stuff. And lo and behold, they found a ridiculously huge problem underneath Wordsmith Air Force Base related to the use of this AFFF firefighting foam that, you know, they spray it on runways and whatnot if there's an airplane that's going to come in and belly flop, because it honestly is the best thing for fighting fuel fires. It's still in use. The stuff that's out there now, for the most part, is a slightly different chemical formula, but it's incredibly persistent in the environment, and they're still learning a lot about what the health effects are, but everything they learn is pretty not good.
It's a technical term.
Yeah.
How about
pretty terrible? And so, you know, but that's not a problem only at Wordsmith. I can tell you that the DEQ is looking at all of the military installations in Michigan to try and find out if there's this problem. This firefighting foam was pretty much, it's on hand at every airport. Every city fire department's got some of it.
It's a national issue, actually.
Worldwide. In fact, PFCs are probably in all of our blood already. At some level, because it's been used, it was the backbone of Teflon. You know, so if you've got Teflon and Scotchgard. that's part of the thing when it comes to chemicals. They come to the market without all of this health study. It's sort of reverse engineered to figure out what the health effects are, and that takes a long, long, long time. And that's part of the reason why there's always sort of these new chemicals that are coming up into the news that you suddenly, I've never heard of this acronym before. What are PFCs? I thought it was PCBs and TCE and
PBB.
Yeah, and PBDEs and, you know, and all of this stuff. And it's just, it's a chemical, it's an acronym soup, and keeping track of it is very difficult. Why I think in the future we all need to pay close attention to anything that's known as an unregulated contaminant, because, you know, lead was an unregulated contaminant at one point, and now it's regulated. So as they learn more and more about it, it gets kind of added to the list.
Pretty not good.
You're not going to let me forget about that one, are you? You know?
And sometimes, I think we hit on it, sometimes it, the drivers are the ability to detect the contaminants. And a good example is the volatile organic compounds. When they started having that ability to detect them in a part per billion, you know, lo and behold, all of a sudden we had all these contaminated sites, right? Well, there's nothing magical about it. It's just that now we have that awareness that they're out there. And City of Kalamazoo has two well fields that they had to install air stripping to get rid of the chlorinated solvents. One central well field, our mother load station, that had tetrachloroethylene from an old abandoned dry cleaners that used to presumably dump some of the waste out there, and that got into the aquifer. Another one by Western Michigan, a vinyl chloride plume that is really never fully determine the source or sources. It's a complicated aquifer system, a tri-aquifer system. But I guess the point is sometimes the technology to detect them drives it. So some of the unregulated contaminants become regulated because of our ability to detect them. But Kalamazoo, just as Jim mentioned, the Wellhead Protection Program is designed to prevent the groundwater supplies from becoming contaminated. And there's seven elements to that program. So when you're in that program, you know, you have to follow those elements. So to the state of Michigan's credit, DEQ's credit, they give grant money every year. And they're, I don't know if they're the only state or one of the few that take some of that revolving fund money that they get from the federal government, and they allow it for the public water supply systems. Not everybody does that, so we're pretty fortunate, because over the years we've pulled in close to $1 million in all these $70,000 grants that we've gotten. So that's really sustained our program. So we're in a pretty good state as far as that goes.
All right. Who has a question? Where's Lindsay? There you go.
I have two questions.
Oh, and if you could say your name and where you're from.
Oh, Fran Melgar, and I'm from Portage. And one question is about if you could just comment on how federal policies that we're hearing about cutting EPA and stuff like that, how much you see that impacting our ability to perform these assessments on the water, or if that's really all a state-funded issue. And then the other question is to just clarify the cost of extracting water, because when I get my water bill and I have a question about the bill, they say, well, you use this much water, so that's why your bill is so expensive this time compared to last time. And you were saying that the farmers are conscientious about how much they use because it is affecting their bill, but yet it's not clear that Nestle is paying to take the water. So I'm not sure if it's just if they are paying the same as we are when we take 800 gallons of water, or if they're getting it free and I'm paying for those 800 gallons of water. You know, that, so that's the other question.
Well, let's take the first one first. Yeah. So,
okay, let's try and break that one down a little bit.
The EPA question. So the budget question.
Okay,
that's
EPA,
a big one.
But yeah, the EPA cuts are absolutely going to hurt the pollution monitoring and enforcement at the state level. It's said that the White House is saying we're trying to return power back to states, but in essence they're slashing funding that is pretty necessary. So I don't see federal funding cuts doing any good in terms of pollution monitoring.
It's just, I mean, it would be shifting costs, would it not? Because a lot of the stuff that the EPA funds, or if they're saying we're going to return it to the states, right, DEQ already takes on a lot of EPA's responsibilities. So if the EPA's, you know, funds got cut, then I don't know how that shift doesn't get transferred to the states, or it gets not done as well.
Right. If you know, it's like beach monitoring or E. coli monitoring, right? You want that to know whether you can swim at the beach without getting sick. Well, you know, the states rely on grant funding for that. And if that federal grant money doesn't come in, where do you get it? Do you go to the local community and say, do you guys want to pick up this big cost for monitoring beaches? Environmental protection programs are usually kind of first on the block for cutting funding. So, you know, I don't see, you know, the DEQ has told me that, you know, most communities probably aren't going to be able to pick that cost up if we can't do it for them.
Yeah, and I think that water sort of got left out of the conversation in President Trump's big discussion on infrastructure. It started falling off the table, so we have to make sure that water is there and so that it does come back in. I think the states do have some resiliency under the Safe Drinking Water Act and Clean Water Act through their programs, but it will definitely cut monitoring, and it will cut new programs. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was funding on-the-ground restoration projects. If that program dies, that will end a lot of wetlands restoration and other things, shoreline restoration. So there's definitely, there'll be some resilience, but it'll definitely hurt. It'll definitely hurt.
The last part of your comment, I believe it was related to why do you have to pay a certain amount when Nestle gets theirs for free, in essence? Where do you get your water? So you pay a municipal hookup fee. You're paying for the delivery, right? That's the cost, I believe. you know, when you don't get Nestle water for free if you want it. You have to buy it. It's whatever dollar on up for a bottle. You're paying for the convenience, right? So that's the cost, right? You know, the city of Portage, I guess maybe this is a question for you. I mean, the city of Kalamazoo has got a lot of money into the operating costs, right? But you're not paying the state of Michigan for the water that you pull out of the ground, right?
No, basically, public water supply systems kind of run like a nonprofit in a sense where you're taking money in with your rates to maintain the system or expand as needed. So I'm not a bean counter, so I can't tell you a lot of it, but I do know, you know, it's based on their size meter, and in Kalamazoo, it's part of the utility bill is part of your wastewater use as well.
That's what I was going to say. Your bill includes stormwater and wastewater and drinking water.
So we want to get to some more questions.
It might be.
Yeah. Lindsay, where are you? There you are. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned the Great Lakes Compact briefly earlier. We spend a good part of the winter in the Southwest where, of course, it's very dry, and we see these big reservoirs on the Colorado River that are almost no more. And just wondering, how strong is that compact if areas outside of the basin want to come after the water here?
Well, I guess we'll find out. I mean,
that's pretty not good.
Yeah. Did you guys see there was news recently, there had been a NASA scientist that said that Great Lakes water is the future of the Southwest. And that surprised everybody because...
He quickly backpedaled on that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that.
But, there's definitely an appetite for Great Lakes water, and that's obviously the reason the compact exists. Waukesha was so staunchly opposed because it set this precedent, and there was all this sort of technical argument for... You know, Waukesha sat right there on this line.
That's what I'm wondering.
Really had bad water.
That community did not have good water.
It came down to they were just at the right place to be able to make their application work. And it withstood an appeal that was recently decided. And I believe the argument that the governors who made the approval was that the way that the groundwater pumping system was working in Waukesha at the time was actually pulling Great Lakes Basin water and then they were discharging it to the Mississippi River already, and that if they actually just put a pipeline to Lake Michigan and then created infrastructure to pipe that water right back to Lake Michigan, they would end an already existing diversion that was sort of de facto happening because it had developed over time. So Waukesha was, you know, it was sort of like the sword for a lot of water diversion opponents to die upon in some ways, and it may have not been the right one. We'll see what kind of subsequent requests for Great Lakes water follow for communities that are on the line or outside the line. And if Waukesha ends up being the legal precedent that allows some other community that really doesn't quite have as strong of an application that ends up being the reason they're allowed to get water, then you'll know that the Great Lakes Compact probably isn't as strong as it should be.
I mean, historically, right, we built these big, you know, water systems. Like New York is very famous, right, for bringing the water into the city from the Catskills and Delaware. They didn't want to use the Hudson because they said, well, it's polluted, you know. And California and other systems. But right now, scarcity is being addressed through wastewater reclamation because it's more cost-effective for those communities, and that's potable reclamation. So you take the water that you've used to flush your toilets and flush everything else, and you bring it back and you purify it and you use it again. And that is how Southern California, Texas, it's more cost effective than ever building a large water project again. And then the legal constraints, I think that the legal issues of designing a compact that would be agreeable would take 50 years if even if we had a law that said, okay, we're going to make all waters of the United States for the good of the U.S. So there's some language around that for a bill, right? It would take a long, long time to do it, and it's really costly to move water and to build these projects. So I think it's pretty resilient. I think the compact we have, I think we need to, and I also think we have really strong agreement around water quality as well compared to many other places. So I think we should
All right, next.
That.
Sorry, next question.
My name's Milton Reddick. I'm from Williamson, too. I think maybe the commission's a bunch of hypocrites. And the reason I say that is we have one of the largest cities in the Midwest, Chicago, flushing their toilets with our water and not repeating, returning it into the lake, correct? So
that's
we
correct.
Worry about a little bit like Waukesha. So the problem, it's a big, now at the time it was done, that's correct. I spent 20 years of my life in San Diego turning sewage into drinking water. The technology is here today. Got some in Grand Rapids. Traverse City's got what they call membrane bioreactors. So the point is, I don't know if it ever could be done, but we should keep our eyes open. We got the biggest water user in the Midwest sucking it out and not returning one drop.
Yeah, I was going to say that we are sending water to the south through the Mississippi. So
right,
the Great Lakes,
the big Chicago River diversion, the grandfathered, it does. It sends it right to the Mississippi. Yeah.
But water scarcity is driven water reuse, as you know, and so that has they have not invested in water reuse technology in the Midwest. I'm a big supporter of it.
All right, next question.
Hi, I'm Dwayne from Portage. I've been in Michigan 30 years, and I've had the opportunity to visit MDEQ or its predecessor by whatever name it was at the time. And what I see is a group of people who largely are trying to do right by us, public servants, and they are just consistently reorganized, demoralized. They're population or body count at MDEQ is at an all-time low. I was talking to an employee from there last week, and she said that they wanted to ask for new money to remediate all these contaminated sites, but last year and the year before they couldn't do it because the legislature was futzing about trying to get money for the roads. And so now when they ask for money because the bond issue's gone, they're on fumes now, the legislature says, why didn't you ask us last year? And so it's kind of like that car insurance commercial, the guy with the fishing line and the dollar bill on it.
You got to be quicker?
Yeah. So apparently that's how the legislature feels about protecting our water. I'm really concerned about the viability of the MDEQ as the bulldog watching our water. I don't think it's viable in the current model, and I see no political party, no politician standing up for them. None.
Yeah, they're facing some cuts to their budget next year, I believe. That's
pretty not good.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Pretty not good. sad.
Sorry, Garrett. It's happening at the national level, too, with EPA. And they're looking at retirements, big retirement, and they're not going to replace those. So it's,
I'd like to echo that. One of the things that that I've seen working in this industry is that, we have questions like Nestle and all these water-related issues, and we sit in it's such a precious space in our country with our water supplies. But yet, Michigan, in general, has not really funded to the level that we need, whether it be DEQ or basic research about our water supplies. You know, I'm working on a project right now, for example, in Texas, and it's amazing how much information Texas has about their aquifer systems. About they've mapped out pretty much every aquifer in Texas. They have all this on a GIS. They were able to provide this information, groundwater models, Dwayne, you'd appreciate, all available at an instant. We got this information. We're not even close to that in Michigan. You know, in Michigan, we had some legislative, we had a groundwater mapping requirement that came out in 2007 to map our groundwater resources. And that resulted in a GIS-based groundwater mapping program that was available to us groundwater scientists. And it actually, at first I was kind of skeptical about it, but it turned out I use it on a daily basis. Well, that's gone now because we lost the funding for that. We don't have this basic tool. And if you go to Indiana, you go to California, Florida, I mean, these states are really advanced in the basic information they have about their water resources, and we're way behind. So, you know, we talk about issues like Nestle and how to deal with those, and but yet just these basic fundamental tools of research into our hydrogeological resources is behind. So, you know, and that puts us at a deficiency. When we go to study these sites, we want to know what happens with Nestle, and when we pump this water, what's happening to our wetlands or what's happening to our streams. And if we don't have that basic research to make that evaluation, if we don't have that data, then we're speculating, or we rely on Nestle to go out there and collect that data, which I don't personally have a problem with. Somebody's got to get that data. So, you know, I think we really need to do some soul searching on this if we really really cherish these resources. Let's get some basic information. Let's start doing some geological mapping. I mean, we have in Kalamazoo the geological, we have the Michigan Geological, pardon?
Survey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what a resource. And they want to collect this data. They're trying to collect this data, and we need more of it.
All right, let's take another question.
My name is Judy, and I live in Oakwood in Kalamazoo. And in changing the subject a little bit, every summer, or actually every year, when we have big rains, and I hear about the wastewater treatment plant in Grand Rapids overflowing into the Grand River, can you tell me if there's anything being done to solve that problem? Or does that happen infrequently enough where we go, oh, well, the solution to pollution is dilution, you know? Is that really something that's going on? Thank you.
Well, we have, I don't know how many CSOs you had probably in this area that you had to fix. They were mandated to fix these combined sewer overflows when it rains. But there's still a lot of facilities that blend when it rains. And so our wastewater system is very leaky, and the flows go up, even if we're not taking stormwater in purposely. So in Grand Rapids, what they've done is they've created a system where they capture some of that flow, pretty big basin. We've studied it. It keeps like 10,000 cryptosporidium oosis out of the river. But we're still getting some spillover. And as we get more variable rainfall events, like these big, this last couple of weeks ago, we had a lot of untreated wastewater entering our waterways throughout Michigan. And so I think people are starting to look at this, what they call high-flow technologies, and they do a pretty good job. We're studying one in Toledo on the wastewater side, not on the drinking water side. So,
and I should say
these are some of the new things that are happening. They're trying.
We have 5 minutes left, so do you have a real quick thing?
I just was wanted to ask you. I mean, Grand Rapids, I know, just went through, like, they...
Major,
yeah. Yeah, we just finished $400 million 30-year
project.
Timing
was really poor.
Yeah.
And then they got the ring.
Okay,
right.
Because they had this big press
ring.
Conference. It was like, yay, we've been working on this project forever to separate the CSO.
Yeah.
And then there was like an announcement the same day or an article in the press that was like, oh, actually, we just had a big overflow at the sewer plant.
And in Michigan, they have to report, which is one good thing. They do have to report that, so we do have that information.
But so they're working on it, but if it was only that simple, I think people are aware of it more, and there's certain things like CSO projects that are specifically trying to be, you know, that people are making progress on, but does that eliminate everything? No.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, real quick, in Kalamazoo, we do have a separate stormwater system than the sanitary, but sanitary sewer overflows do occur. Sometimes they could get into the storm and into the waterways. There's a whole separate program for that. We didn't even touch on stormwater and their relationship with groundwater and surface water, but that's another whole element of a discussion sometime.
All right, so with our last 5 minutes... I want to go around, the five of you. Give me a real short, so we can sleep tonight. Give me something that's hopeful when it comes to drinking water.
Wow.
Garrett, you're first.
Or
an action item, that would work, sure, okay.
If you're concerned about your drinking water, your particular drinking water, you know... I guess I would say that maybe getting back to your point about the DEQ and you know they get a bad rap and they're in a tough spot. My experience in dealing with the DEQ at all kinds of I deal with DEQ in air quality and water resources and Office of Drinking Water and remediation and redevelopment and the executive staff. I have talked to people in all of them, and I think they're civil servants with their hearts in the right place. And you know, there are stories like Nestle and Flint, and you know, I think if Flint hadn't happened, you know, we wouldn't be hating on the DEQ as much. And it's not to say that they don't deserve a ton of, you know, deserve the criticism that comes with Flint. But, you know, the drinking water, Flint has overshadowed, I think, a lot of really good work that's being done by civil servants and public utilities. I think Kalamazoo was able to, you know, do some work to drop its LCR level down significantly over the last year. And so I guess it's not all doom and gloom. How's that?
That's good. Okay, Lindsay,
yeah,
go.
No, I think that's a good point. The catch-22 sort of DEQ is in. I think that's a very valid point. There are definitely good people at DEQ, and they're getting hated on right now for sure. Just some credit. So if you haven't done what I said earlier, I'm going to keep this on, you know, 60 seconds or less. Check out what your water service line is. Call your city. Figure out what you have under the ground in front of your house. I think that's important, and everybody can do that, and it affects your family immediately, right? So know that. The other thing is President Trump. Can I say something? We haven't even very limited comments about President Trump tonight. So President Trump really wants infrastructure spending. He said that, you know, that this is really important. And the EPA folks that I've talked to at Region 5 up in Chicago, which is where our region is, you know, controls Michigan, say, we want that. Hook us up with service line replacements. I mean, if we can help Kalamazoo, what do you got, 8,000-9,000 lead service lines off the top of your head?
We have less than 3,000 known, but we have about 5,000 undefined, which means we don't
them.
Know.
For what? At your cost. They're
correct.
Not charging the homeowner, okay? So guess what? Everybody's paying for that. So what I'm saying is that I see sort of this, if we can bring anything out of Flint, it's that all these cities have lead service lines in the ground, or a lot of older cities have lead service lines in the ground. And yes, they may be using corrosion control and treating their water properly, but as long as those are in the ground, they're a potential risk. So if we want to spend money on infrastructure, shoot.
Okay, what's your brief take-home message?
We're not Flint, but...
Yeah. And
that's one another good thing about groundwater. It's less corrosive, generally, than surface water. But we have had a corrosion control program for a long time, kind of indirectly, actually. The city has been using a type of phosphate since the 50s to keep the iron in solution. But a side benefit of that is it transforms into orthophosphate, which is what you hear about coating the lines, the water lines, to prevent the lead from leaching out. So Kalamazoo, we're constantly removing the lead surfaces as we find them, usually associated with street construction projects and especially during monitoring years. We do provide free samples, so if you do suspect you have a lead surface, we can go on there, and if you do, we'll take the test, and if it's elevated, then it goes in a priority to remove it.
Right, Jim?
Not every city does that, by the way. They should get credit for that. Kalamazoo, you should really get credit for that.
Well, you know, Lindsay mentioned infrastructure spending, and we're really seeing that. I work for an engineering firm that works on a lot of infrastructure projects, and what we're seeing is money become available to do infrastructure improvements. And on the water supply side, we work with a lot of rural communities that it's actually sometimes I'm just shocked by some of these water supplies and how worn out they are. I mean, we really see water supplies that that have been operating for more than 50 years. You look at this infrastructure and you think, oh my gosh, you know, it's time for some updates. And we're seeing that money become available, and we're able to get that through. Our communities are able to get that through grants or low income or low interest loans. And really make a difference, and it just brightens my day when I work with these communities. And we take this old beat up well system that's you look at and you think, oh my gosh, you know, how does this thing even operate? And provide them with a new water supply that's going to last their community for another 50 or 100 years. So anyway, that's a real positive thing,
and it's happening.
Well, you know, we're starting to talk about this idea of one water and cities of the future. And, you know, we have the ability in the state of Michigan to be really aspirational in this. And we just ran a competition, and the undergraduate students self-formed and did a drinking water fountain competition. They chose either school or community. And the finalists, the seven finalists, were fantastic. The student fountain was provided potable water and education, new electronic systems, this cool design. The community fountains were art, space, and potable water. And these were for real designs, for real cities in the state of Michigan. And some of the communities want to build these now. So I think we can be aspirational, and I think we can be a leader in this area. So go support water. toast to water. That's what I say.
All right. Thank you so much for coming tonight. You've been a wonderful audience. Please give our panelists a last round of applause.